Welcome to a Summer by the Sea podcast. I'm Greg Muller. I'm at the Queenscliff Ferry Terminal on the Ballerine Peninsula. We're about to board the Sea Road Ferry across to Sorrento. Summer by the Sea is run by Coastcare Victoria, with the aim of inspiring people to learn more about this state's beautiful coastline, and in turn, find out what you can do to protect these unique environments. Just waiting for the cars to load, and then we'll make our way onto the top deck. It's an open deck, there's an inside area too, but on a day like today, why be inside? And the views are fantastic. With me is...
My name's Mark Rodrigue. I'm the program leader for Marine and Coast with Parks Victoria, and it's a great pleasure to be welcoming you here in this virtual way down to Port Phillip Heads Marine National Park. It's a beautiful, slightly sunny day, a little bit overcast, but it's a fabulous day for seeing a little bit about the amazing cultural and natural values of this particular part of the world. It's a very rich area, from Aboriginal history to the geology of the area, through to our fantastic Marine National Park that we're going to talk a bit about during the course of our journey. So strap yourselves in and let's go for a bit of a ride on the ferry.
And I should just say we're travelling from Queenscliff to Sorrento, so if you're going the other way, you just have to keep that in mind or listen to it backwards or something.
Absolutely. Before we begin today, I just want to start by paying my respect to traditional owners, past, present, and elders emerging. We very much respect across the whole of the state in working with our traditional owner partners, Aboriginal values, and work to hopefully support and protect some of those important values across the state.
That's probably a good place to start because there's a rich Aboriginal history in this park as well.
This particular part of the world is very much part of Aboriginal country. On this side of the bay, on the Queenscliff side, is the Wadawurrung people who are basically whose traditional areas stretch from Aries Inlet down on the west coast all the way through to Werribee, and then from Queenscliff and the waters surrounding it up to Ballarat. So that's the Wadawurrung area. We're also travelling today across to Sorrento, which is part of the Bunurong traditional owner area. And that area extends all the way from the edge of the bay right down into South Gippsland and extending into Wilson's Promontory.
And there's stories in the Aboriginal community here of what this place was like thousands and thousands of years ago.
That's right. Aboriginal people have lived in this part of Victoria for many, many tens of thousands of years and certainly have seen dramatic change in the landscape. When we look back at the history of Port Phillip Bay, it's important to know that the bay has changed dramatically in terms of the area that it covers during periods of sea level rise or fall. Back in the period around about 18 to 20,000 years ago, when certainly Aboriginal people would have been living in this area, sea levels globally were around about 100 metres lower than they are today. And that's because much of the world's oceans were actually frozen as big polar ice caps. Over the subsequent 12,000 years or so, those ice caps gradually melted and the sea level rose, flooding what was then a low-lying valley. They flooded the valley as seawater came in through the heads and gave the bay a shape similar to what it is today. But that whole dynamic of the changing nature of the bay, the way the water came and went, was very much part of Aboriginal stories and the knowledge of this particular area, given the fact that they've lived here for such a long period of time. At the entrance to the bay, today we know of, through underwater mapping, through some surveys using sonar and other devices, there's a very clear break in the bay where the Yarra River, as it would have been 20,000 years ago, carved its way out through a low-lying valley, made its way out through what we now know as the Rip itself, and didn't actually enter the ocean to round about where King Island is on the western side of Bass Strait. In that period when sea levels were lower, there are some clear drops in terms of the underwater geology. At the time when Aboriginal people would have been walking around this area 18,000 years or so ago, there was a waterfall. And in fact, in some of the stories, traditional owner stories from this particular area, they talk about the mist that actually formed not only here, but all the way up through into the Yarra Valley itself. And the people, the Bunurong people in particular, had a very strong connection with this underwater waterfall as we know it today. Those headlands that make up the entrance of the bay as we see it today, Point Nepean on the east side, and Point Lonsdale over on the west side is a fairly narrow opening. There's actually quite extensive reefs that extend from both sides of the bay. From Point Nepean, the reef system runs about 600 metres out in towards the middle of the rip, and from the Point Lonsdale side, it's closer to a kilometre. These reefs basically form a very natural protection, and when the first navigators, the European navigators, found their way down into this part of the world and they came inside the bay, they went from a fairly hostile Bass Strait environment to a very sheltered, protected, safe environment. Matthew Flinders, in his diaries from the early 1800s, describes entering Port Phillip Bay as coming in on the evening as the tide was coming in. They could hear the waves breaking at Point Nepean and Point Lonsdale, and not being great light, they weren't exactly sure how far away from those treacherous rocks they might be. Unfortunately for them, they continued to travel pretty well due north and ran straight into the Great Sands area at Mud Islands, became firmly wedged on the sandbars there, and it took a couple of days for them to navigate their way back off again. As far as the distance across is concerned, it's about 4 kilometres from one side to the other. But look, in terms of understanding it as a barrier to the tidal movement in and out of the bay, if we take, for example, just tidal levels down here at Point Lonsdale, they range about 2.5 metres or so in terms of their variation from high tide to low tide. When you go up to Williamstown at the northern end of the bay, the tidal variation is only about 60 to 80 centimetres. So it really does hold back a lot of the water. There are times, particularly when it's full high tide outside the bay, where it almost looks like as you're approaching the entrance to the bay that you're looking uphill. And while I know water is supposed to be flat, you can actually see the difference in height between the water inside and outside of the bay. One of the spectacular things of the underwater environments around Point Nepean and Point Lonsdale is the diversity of invertebrate filter feeding animals, or animals that basically live stuck on the rock. They filter their food from the material that's flowing past them. And they do certainly give this particular part of the world some incredible colour. A lot of the species that are found here are found nowhere else apart from here in southeastern Australia. The colour and diversity can certainly be described and as similar to, and in my view, even better than places like the Great Barrier Reef. So it is really quite a spectacular underwater environment. And divers, scuba divers, who are well prepared with nice thick wetsuits because of the chilly water, who are prepared for a bit of current and not always perfect visibility, will see some of the most spectacular underwater environments anywhere on the planet, right here in the Port Phillip Heads area.
The other thing you often see if you spend some time at Queenscliff with the pilot boats going out to collect the larger ships coming in, how treacherous are these waters at the heads?
So Port Phillip Heads is a really nasty piece of work when it comes to navigation. The whole area, in fact, between the Wilson's Promontory and Cape Otway is notorious, and there are numerous shipwrecks both outside of the bay in that area that I've just spoke about, but in particular around the entrance to Port Phillip Bay, there'd be something like 40 plus shipwrecks. One of the things that's quite unusual about Queenscliff, if we look back over off the ferry towards the south, we can see that there are actually two lighthouses at Queenscliff, the Black Lighthouse and the White Lighthouse. And these were built during the latter part of the 1800s to try and give guidance to vessels coming in through the bay as to the safe line for travelling. As if you're coming in through the bay and you can line up the Black and the White Lighthouse with each other, you can come in on the straight lead coming, the main shipping lead coming into the bay itself.
This is fascinating. So maybe just some nuts and bolts of this trip. So how long does this ferry take?
So the ferry from Queenscliff to Sorrento or vice versa, generally somewhere between 40 and 50 minutes, depending upon the sea conditions.
And just as an indication, to drive from this one point to the other, it's about 3 hours, is that right?
Correct. Unfortunately, I've missed the ferry on a couple of rude occasions, especially with the kids in the back seat of the car.
That gives a good indication of what a large body of water is and what a narrow opening.
Correct. It really is quite an amazing bay. It's one of the probably larger embayments anywhere in the world.
So, Mike, just to the left of us, just to the north of us, very low-lying strip of rocks. What's that?
This is a structure known as Pope's Eye, or the Annulus. Essentially, it formed one of a number of structures built in the mid to late 1800s to provide some protection for the entrance to Port Phillip Bay. during this period of time, Victoria had just been through an amazing gold rush, and people were coming from far and wide across the planet to Victoria to essentially dig up or find, make their strike it lucky and find some of that beautiful yellow stuff under the ground. Because of the wealth of Victoria, there was a lot of concern at the time that Victoria was a very easy target for enemy countries that might want to come and invade. Pope's Eye was going to be a fort, but it was never actually completed. Pope's Eye, in particular, though, has been a very important place in the story of marine protected areas in Australia. Back in the late 1970s, a whole lot of scuba divers got together and lobbied the government for the creation of Victoria's first marine protected area, or a national park-like system for the underwater environment. Pope's Eye became part of what was then known as the Harold Holt Fisheries Reserve. And this reserve included Point Nepean, Point Lonsdale, Mud Islands, Swan Bay and Pope's Eye, all of which ended up becoming part of what's now known as the Port Phillip Heads Marine National Park. Pope's Eye, of all of the sites in the Harold Holt Reserve, was a fully protected area, which means that fishing inside or outside the rocks for a distance of 100 metres from the centre was completely prohibited. And as a consequence of that, now some 45 years or so since its original protection, it is one of the best places to see large fish, fish that are residential, fish that are hanging around the reef systems, around the kelp forests, that really use that place as a home.
So speaking of the military, I guess, infrastructure here, there's quite a rich military history, especially around World War I and II.
The military history here is quite notable, and there are claims made, and that I have heard a little bit of a controversy as to who actually fired the first shot, but the people over at Point Nepean, the fort at Point Nepean, were claimed to be the group that fired the first shot in both the First and the Second World War. In relation to the First World War, a German ship that was, after war had been declared, was trying to escape from the port of Melbourne, get underway and get out into the open sea. They knew essentially that the war was about to be declared and tried to make their way out. The good folks at Point Nepean observed them and fired a warning shot over the bow, asking them to return to port, which fortunately for all concerned, they turned around and went back into Melbourne.
Just walking across the other side of the boat, so the south side, starboard side, we can see the quarantine station.
The quarantine station was built in the mid-1800s. At the time, the young colony of Melbourne was getting ships from all around the world, and there were a lot of risks associated with the young colony, people coming from other parts of the world where diseases were prevalent. And we had some fairly significant diseases. This is well and truly before the day when antibiotics and vaccines were available. I guess there's some parallels thinking about the world as it is at the moment under COVID. But back in the 1800s, the main thing that could be done is to stop ships and to ensure that good medical checks and people arriving in the colony were carried out. So the quarantine station was built particularly after a ship known as the Ticonderoga that sailed out from England. And the Ticonderoga, coming out from Liverpool, had 714 passengers, but during the passage more than 100 people died along the way due to typhoid and scarlet fever. So the ship was stopped there, everyone was interned at the quarantine station in tents, and depending upon your status in life you might have got a room. But it really started a whole principle of trying to keep diseases out of the colony itself. Unfortunately, people, their journey from England did end at the quarantine station. There's a small graveyard that can be visited within the national park, has the remains of some of those people who unfortunately perished. Still, the quarantine station played a fantastic role in protecting the young colony and keeping some of those very significant and dangerous diseases out.
And that bay is named after that ship, is that right?
That's right. The Ticonderoga Bay is the area directly in front of the quarantine station itself. This area does actually form part of what's known as a dolphin reserve. This particular area is well known as a calving area for bottlenose dolphins, or sometimes known as Burren dolphins, a species that's believed to be quite unique to Port Phillip and Western Port and the Gippsland Lakes. Just to the south of the ferry at the moment, you can see four yellow cone-like buoys floating out there that mark the edges of the Portsea Hole section of the Port Phillip Heads Marine National Park. This section of the park is actually one of the deepest sections of Port Phillip Bay. It is, in fact, a remainder of the old Yarra River bed, and for scuba divers in particular, it's one of the places where you can get a little bit deeper than you can in other parts of the bay, diving down to around about 35 or 36 metres or so. Because it's an old river valley, for divers, when you get down and visit the site, you can actually see the old twisting watercourse. It looks very much like a river valley with sort of fairly steep-sided walls, rock walls on it. And the rock walls are covered in invertebrate animals, so filter feeding things like sponges, some sea squirts, some ascidians, soft corals that literally line the edges of the rock around that riverbed and give it some fantastic underwater colour. It really is quite one of the most spectacular diving locations in the bay, although quite challenging to dive there, given the very large tidal movements. The currents that operate in this area are extremely fast. It'd be a foolish diver who sort of simply just jumped in the water because there's a place to go and look at without looking first at the tides. And the water inside Portsea Hole itself moves incredibly quickly. So it's what we call a slack water dive. When the tide is finished its run, it's not moving too much at all. You generally have a window somewhere between 20 and 50 minutes or so where it's called slack water. That's the time to dive Portsea Hole, not any other time. So just as we're travelling along the coast from Portsea around to Sorrento, we're going to pass Point King, a fairly important part of Victoria's history. This was actually where the first settlement took place. There was a penal settlement set up there. It wasn't necessarily a great start to the relationship with our Indigenous people because there was a skirmish that took place and there was some deaths, I think, on both sides of the equation. Interestingly, one of the inmates, it was a penal settlement, so convicts were based there, was a gentleman by the name of William Buckley. And Buckley himself actually managed to escape from the Sorrento penal settlement. Buckley decided to walk around the bay, and he literally walked all the way up through to the northern section across the swampy areas of around where Melbourne is today, and ended up being found by some Aboriginal people, the Wadawurrung people, over on this side of the Queenscliff side of the bay, somewhere near St Leonard's. They took him under their wings, fed him, brought him back to health, and he spent the next 30 or so years living in different parts of the Bellarine Peninsula, primarily at Point Lonsdale. There's a sea cave under the lighthouse at Point Lonsdale known as Buckley's Cave, where he apparently spent quite a bit of time gazing out to sea, looking at the passing ships and possibly dreaming of England, but we don't know really what happened there. Okay, so if we're looking north across the bay, you can see in the far distance, if you look very carefully, and depending upon how hazy it is, the tall buildings in the city area itself. So it is quite a long way. It's around about 40 kilometres or so in a straight line. But in between, one of the things that's very obvious is the shallow water. This area is known as the Great Sands. In most places, those areas are still covered by water, but in a few locations, there is so much sand that's built up that they've broken the surface. And the islands to the north of us are known as mud islands. One of the most important bird breeding sites in the whole Port Phillip Bay region, with many of our seabirds and water birds starting their life off over on these relatively secure islands where there aren't a large number of predators and other things getting around. Most of the seagulls, the silver gulls as they're more properly called, start their life off on mud islands. Many of the pelicans that are found around Port Phillip Bay and over in Western Port start their life off as chicks on mud islands. And there's a whole bunch of seabirds and particularly wader birds that fly to mud islands from as far away as places like Siberia, from Alaska, from China and Japan. But mud islands is a particularly important component of what's known as the Port Phillip Western Shoreline Bellarine Peninsula Ramsar site, and like Swan Bay and many other places on the eastern side of the bay, has got important values for seabirds and particularly these migratory species that move between continents. On the top of the islands, there's small shrubby plants known as salt marshes that can survive in those tough salty, sort of windy environments. Below the surface of the water, much of the island's lagoon and the surrounding areas is covered in what we call seagrass, a flowering plant that is particularly important from the point of view of fish. Many different types of fish, including some of our important commercial and recreational species, breed or their larvae basically develop in the seagrass and grow up and then move outside those areas to other parts of the bay. It's an important habitat for fish, and again, for anyone who loves fishing should really become a bit more familiar with seagrass, because quite a number of our recreationally and commercially important fish species actually start their life or have a dependency on seagrass habitats at places like Mud Islands. Leaving some of these areas aside as marine protected areas, this is part of the Marine National Park, is an important way of actually contributing towards the future sustainability of fish and fisheries. If you enjoy fishing, you should also think about the value of protecting some areas that we leave aside so that animals like fish can actually produce the next generation, and from those areas can disperse into areas far and wide. Oh, we're at Sorrento. We're here already. All right, we can see if you look ahead now the Sorrento Pier. This is one of the older piers in the southern part of the bay. But one of the things, if you're looking to the south of the ferry, that you can see in the boat, in the mooring ground off Sorrento, is quite a large number of what are referred to as cooter boats. Cooter boats essentially were a locally designed adaptation of a Scottish kind of fishing vessel that was used for particularly actively fishing in quite heavy seas. They're quite wide or beamy. The cooter boats that essentially were redesigned or developed here in Sorrento, and also by some families over at Queenscliff, were very popular for going out and catching barracuda. Barracuda are large predatory fish that once upon a time were probably one of the more numerous fish around found around the entrance to the bay, and there was a very active commercial barracuda fishery. They can probably be best described as a wide, beamy boat. They have a bowsprit or a piece of wood that extends out beyond the front of the bow itself to allow the large sails that go on the front to be tied there and give them a much greater sail area. But yeah, something very typical, very popular these days, popular as recreational boats, and there's a whole history of looking at boat building and particularly the cooter boats that can be seen in some of the maritime museums, such as over in Queenscliff or here in Sorrento.
So after 200 years of European settlement, an active military history, Australia's second largest city at the top of the bay, fishing, tourism, etc., how healthy is the bay now?
So I guess when you're asking a question about how healthy is the bay, I would look at it and say the majority of it is actually in really good condition. When you consider that there's 4.5 million or so people live around the bay itself, around the shorelines of the bay, that's comparable with other bays in other parts of the world, long gone in terms of their biodiversity. It's not to say that we don't have other problems. One of the challenges being a large port. Port Phillip Bay has well over 100 known introduced marine animals and plants. Fortunately, not all of these are major problems. Some of them are fairly benign. They'll live stuck on a pier pylon or maybe be a bit of growth on the bottom of a boat. There are, however, unfortunately, around about 10 or so species of animals and plants that live here in the bay that have come from other countries that are prolific, that have actually changed the nature of the bay itself. One is something called the Northern Pacific Sea Star. In the first few years, there were a few individuals being found, but within a period of around 5 to 6 years or so, their estimated populations hit north of 100 million animals in the bay. A plant that's quite common and unfortunately now here quite prolific in the southern end of the bay is something called Undaria, also known as wakame or Japanese kelp, which as the name suggests originates in the waters around Japan. Unfortunately here, it's also managed to colonise and take advantage of a lack of predators and has become in some parts of the bay extremely prolific. It shades out and competes with the native kelps that should be providing habitat for other things.
How do people get involved in some of the conservation measures here?
Port Phillip Heads area has got quite a number of different community groups that are very active in helping groups like Parks Victoria and other local councils to look after the natural and the cultural values of this really significant area. There are a number of different volunteer groups that operate on both sides of the bay that can all be relatively easily accessed through an online portal known as Park Connect that Parks Victoria operates on our website. You can type in your area of interest. It might be helping out with planting or weeding. It might be doing citizen science activities such as bird monitoring or helping us in the marine environment in terms of looking at some of the key habitats like measuring the health of seagrass. There are lots of different things that volunteers can actually do to help look after this fantastic environment. And I'd encourage you to have a bit of a look at both the Parks Victoria and the Coastcare Victoria's website to see what volunteer opportunities there might be that you can tap into yourself. And don't forget the sunscreen and to wear a hat.
We've got first aid kits on board, life jackets at all time on the vessel. We'll head straight out the Pope's Eye. We've got a special trick that we've got my keys.
After getting off the ferry, Mark took me on a much smaller boat for a closer look at some of the places we could see from the ferry which have some particularly interesting wildlife.
Pope's Eye is part of the Port Phillip Heads Marine National Park, and it's got a whole lot of important things about it, both above the water and also below. One of the things that's pretty exciting for people who get a chance to visit Pope's Eye is a chance to see a colony of seabirds that are actually breeding out there on the rocks and on the platform that have been built specifically for the birds themselves. The birds we're talking about are Australasian gannets. They are seabirds, true seabirds in the sense that they spend their time out feeding on the open surface of the water, but they need to return to solid real estate in order to be able to breed. The adult birds have got bright yellowish heads with a beautiful blue ring around the outside of their eye. Very long, sharp, pointed beak. To feed, they'll get 20, 30 metres above the surface of the water, fold their wings back and fall like a bullet out of the sky straight under the surface, where they'll swim anything up to 10 metres below the surface and grab fish on their way back to the surface using their wings to fly literally under the water. You can actually get a really close look at these birds by using the webcam that's been installed here at Pope's Eye to be able to get a first-hand glimpse into the daily life of a gannet. It is quite an extraordinary opportunity to sort of peer into their world, and you can follow them. And I'm a regular visitor, go in and have a look and see what the gannets are up to today. You can see when they've started to get together, when they the pairs rebond again and come back together after a period of time apart in the early part of the year. You can see the nest building and the gathering of seaweed and other material to help build those wonderful nests. You can see the first of the eggs starting to be laid in those nests, the juveniles, the fluffy marshmallow things emerging from those eggs, and then watch them as they grow through and mature into their final adult form.
And you can also jump online and see what's going on under the water here.
That's correct. So the webcam, it's called ReefCam, if people want to search, set up by the Nature Conservancy, gives you a chance, a unique perspective of looking what a protected area looks like under the water. Pope's Eye, like all parts of the Port Phillip Heads Marine National Park and other marine national parks and marine sanctuaries here in Victoria, is a no-take area. That means it's a great place to come and explore, whether it's above the surface to see the birds or it's down below the surface. We leave the spear gun in the car, back in the car park, and certainly leave the fishing rod at home, because these areas are fully protected areas, protected by law. So remember, if you're visiting a marine national park or marine sanctuary, including Pope's Eye, these are very important no-take areas. We're now at the caisson, or sometimes known as the Chinaman's Hat. The structure itself is actually a palace for Australian fur seals that come into the bay, not to breed, but to simply get out of the water to rest. Here in the bay at the moment, we have mostly, as you can probably hear in the background, We've got a lot of young seals, particularly young male seals, that tend to spend a bit of their time sort of having a bit of argy-bargy with each other, building their skills to the point when they're about 5 or 6 years old, they'll actually start to go into a breeding colony and competing with the other males for space. So the sort of behaviours that we can hear and see today are going on are very much about preparation for that big battle that's going to come ahead in terms of maintaining a breeding colony or a group of animals, a group of females, a harem, essentially, that male seal will mate with and obviously pass on their genes to the next generation. I guess it's also a very poignant thing to think about. Occasionally, unfortunately, our Parks Victoria team and our colleagues at Zoos Victoria are called out here to Pope's Eye to pick up seals that have been injured, largely because of issues to do with what we do on our land, in our land environments. It's not unusual to find seals with either fishing line or some form of plastic packing tape, other plastic materials wrapped around them, and these materials don't move as the seal grows, eventually causing quite nasty lacerations. So it is a reminder that the fact that this is not a bay out in the middle of nowhere, this is a bay surrounded by 4 million people. Whatever goes in our waterways, whatever goes down our drains, ends up in the seal's backyard, basically, and can create some problems there.
We've spent a fair bit of time talking about what's under the water here at the head of the bay. So before we go, I have a special recording of what that environment actually sounds like. It's amazing. That's a recording taken in the shallow waters of the Great Sands or Mud Island. What you can hear are marine crustaceans in the seagrass beds. Summer by the Sea is organised by Coastcare and Parks Victoria. It's a great way to learn about the amazing marine species and habitats along Victoria's coastline. Also, volunteers and community organisations are critical to run this program. Indeed, a lot of the events are organised and run by people who work hard to protect and improve the health of Victoria's marine and coastal environments. Summer by the Sea events show people how we can all make a difference. I'm Greg Muller. Thanks for listening.